Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
Fresh with all the weekend sporting activity in his head is Adam White. He's back again. Good morning to you, Whitey.
It is extraordinary the amount of different things that happened over the course of the weekend across so many different sports, so many different stories. Yeah, it's been amazing. But I'll just get straight into it and say congratulations on your victory on Saturday. It was inspiring. You made a lot of people very happy. And, yeah, well done.
Thank you very much.
Not much more to add. I can't really get into you or anything.
No, you can't this week. No, no, you cannot this week, which is quite nice, which is probably the most satisfying part of the whole experience from my perspective, knowing that when I came in Monday morning, I wasn't going to cop it from you blokes. But it was good fun. Adam Ramanaskis is a former Bombers champion. He knows all about winning these days, manager to the Stars. He gets all the great contracts because he's the big dog in town. Morning to you, Rama.
Yes, good morning. It was a fantastic weekend of sport, and I agree with Whitey. Congratulations. I was a little bit concerned, though, half when I saw you sort of in the middle of the team song making All About You and all that. But look,
I was dragged in.
That's okay. It's, you know,
kicking and screaming.
The girls' time, but you just, you know, you want to take their thunder. That's okay. You go for it.
They sang the song beautifully out in the Oval.
They did. Yeah, it takes me back to. I think Whitey, a little bit of criticism here. Do you remember when Hawthorn walked off arm in arm?
Oh, yeah. Don't worry.
I tend to think maybe D. Half had said to the girls, look, let's sing it out on the ground. Usually you go back to the sheds and in the privacy.
To be honest, in the women's football, they actually do it out on the ground.
Thank you, Adam. White, not Ramanaskis.
Yes.
It's what they do. Yeah. The girls sing it out on the Oval.
They're very joyful.
Hmm. Why wouldn't you be? Playing the best game in the world and a win? Why wouldn't you want to be joyful?
No, I'm just saying they're very joyful. They even when they kick a goal, they get very excited.
Energy is a very important thing in the game of footy. Energy is very, very important.
But it's amazing to watch the improvement of your girls, particularly in the last 3 weeks, from where you started to where you are now
where they were last year.
Oh, don't worry about last year. I think more round one. That round one was probably. A bit of a rude shock of one, how good North Melbourne were, but two, I thought, I was expecting more of Half personally.
You're an idiot.
But to where they are at round three, I think is credit to you, mate. So well done.
It's a lot of people, not just me. The girls did a great job and have done for the last couple of weeks. But you talk about the scoring. We had 8 goals from the Kangas, and this is over just over half of sort of traditional men's football time. 8 goals from the Kangas, 10 from us. Freo put on 7 in 2.5 quarters and couldn't quite find one after that. Adelaide kicked 10 yesterday, Melbourne 9 as well. So it's becoming more fluent, which is good. It's opening up. The game's opening up, which is important.
What about the best player in the competition, her first half?
Erin Phillips, you're talking about?
Yes, I am.
She's pretty bloody good.
I think she had kicked 3 goals and had 18 possessions in the first half.
I'm astounded at your knowledge, Rama. It's fantastic.
I'm following my man over
here. Yeah, I know,
here.
But you're knowing other games.
I'm following my man.
What's happening in the development league, Rama?
No, can't keep up with that one.
Under-18s, have we taken that over yet?
Not quite.
What is happening in the under-18s? What is the future for the under-18s?
It's bubbling along quite nicely, I think. I think you'll find there'll be announcements in the coming weeks, but it's bubbling along quite nicely.
Will every game be televised or have some sort of viewing opportunity? Yeah, streaming.
Potentially, yes. That's where... Still just waiting on that to happen. And that's very exciting. Very exciting that you'll be able to watch it from your tablet or phone or whatever you want to use.
You're a football consumer. Adam White?
Yep.
Would you consume under-18 football?
No.
Right.
No. But, I mean... Apparently people will, so that's good. But that's not for me. I will watch it around the championships time just to get a bit of an interest in as to who might be drafted and what sort of the players are like. I watch a bit of APS football because I was, you know, involved in that a long time ago. I was involved in the under-18 championship, so I used to cover it, and I really did get into it, enjoyed it. So when it came to draft time, you knew all the kids and you sort of knew what was going to happen. But you got to invest a lot of time into that sort of stuff. And I just think that I've said this before, and I'm sure I'll say it again. You know, that we are not America, and in America, the college system is almost as big, at times, if not bigger, than what the NFL is. So all the young men that that get drafted, everybody knows who they are before they get drafted, which makes the NFL draft such a big thing. And I just don't think that that will ever happen here in Australia.
But if the opportunity is, just playing the devil's advocate here, because I tend to agree with you, if the opportunity is for people to get access to these games and learn about these players and know them better, will it become more relevant?
I think it will help. There's no doubt about that, but I just don't know how many people outside sort of family and friends and a few others would you know, religiously watch it on the stream. I think one thing I would probably do is find a way to potentially have the game of the week on Fox Footy, maybe like a Monday night sort of game or something during the week that they could do. I know when I was involved in Fox Footy the first time round, and I was probably a bit desperate, but late at night, every night they had the state-based competition game of the week. And so you'd watch the SANFL one night, the VFL one night, and the Waffle another night. And I remember watching that. I used to love watching the SANFL and the Waffle because, you know, you get your players that weren't playing for their respective, you know, West Coast or for South Australia, for the Crows or whatever, but then some of the players that have retired that have gone across there. But then you also, there's some of the younger players that you got to then see when they got drafted. I remember watching Bryce Gibbs kick 8 goals for Glenelg one day, playing full forward as a 17-year-old. So, I just think you got to put it more on the television, but I'm old, so...
That's what people will do.
Young people will stream it now and stuff.
They'll start to hear about the next Bryce Gibbs or the like, and they'll say, well, I want to have a quick look. Look, by no means is the streaming of games trying to be like college football or basketball in America. You got to remember, colleges in America have got, you know, upwards of 50,000 students.
Yeah, exactly.
And then obviously all past students that went to all those colleges. So, but I think there's a spot for it. I think people want content. You know, if you can go back and watch a highlights of a game midweek and just see a little bit there, I think why not? You got to remember 55% of the drafts coming out of the under 18 competition.
All right, I'm going to play a game with you.
Oh,
because my view is it's got to the point here in Australia that there is too much sport. There's too many sports that want to have that captive audience, okay? And I just don't think there's enough sports to go around. So on
sports
Friday night, I've got
plenty of sports to go around. There's enough people.
Enough interest in all of those sports. So let's go to Friday night, okay?
Yep, Friday night.
Friday night.
Take me to Friday night.
The Big Bash across Fox and Channel 7. What do you think the audience was?
675,000.
Remember? So this is Melbourne Renegades in a really good game in that semi-final.
450.
1.051 million people watched that.
That was close.
Okay, so that's domestic cricket.
I was just doing free-to-air. The Fox would have been about 1.05, I reckon.
Fox was
I was only doing sort of metropolitan area.
Next was the NRL All-Stars. What do you reckon that was?
500.
552.
Ooh.
Across subscription and free-to-air. Then it was the Brumbies and the Rebels. That was on Fox.
250.
140.
56.
Ooh, close again.
Wellington and Melbourne Victory?
32.
31.
Oh.
MBL?
12.
22.
Oh, I was going to say 78.
AFLW, North versus Dogs, Fox Footy?
35.
41.
19.
Oh, again.
And Newcastle and Melbourne City was the other one.
Newcastle, Melbourne City,
8.
Eight.
Made a bad day.
18.
15.
It's close.
18. Oh, yes.
So, but my point on that is lots of different sports to consume.
That's a big Friday night.
On Friday night. But you can't watch them all. And when push comes to shove, the traditional sports will always be head and shoulders ahead of everybody else.
So what did you watch on Friday night?
Oh, I watched the Renegades. I loved that game. That was a great game. But again, I'm traditionally my watcher.
Yeah. I watched the cricket and the basketball on Friday night.
Yeah. But my point is that when you're trying to commercialise your sport and trying to make money out of your sport, you've got to have more than 20,000 people watching it on television. And that's the big challenge for a lot of those sports. And I'm not just talking about AFLW here. I'm talking about A-League. I'm talking about the NBL. That when a lot is on and you tend to gravitate to the bigger sport, how you commercialise your own sport is very, very difficult in such a crowded market, which is what February has become. I mean, I haven't even got there, the golf, because the Perth Sixers finished at 8 o'clock on Friday night.
But is that a reflection of the AFL's domination through the winter months?
Well, the AFL's not part of that.
No, but I'm saying that those sports don't want to go in the winter to come up against the AFL.
Well,
you can't take the big dogs on.
That's right.
But this is the whole thing, that's why the summer is jam-packed, and it's hard to get traction. Mm. And, you know, there's been so much commentary around the cricket about how, the Big Bash has gone too long and this and that. To me, I find that absolute rubbish, because at the end of the day, you're comparing it against nothing, because previously, through that period, all cricket was international cricket. Yep. So now you've got a domestic product that can rate 1 million people.
That's the final, though.
But even through Melbourne the teams. Year, it was, well, that should be...
If it was Adelaide, Brisbane.
Well, that was, no, that well, that game on Friday night was a Sydney team.
Oh, sorry, that was Sydney Melbourne,
team.
Yeah.
Mm. But my point is that even if it was between 400 and 600,000 through the regular games, when everyone's saying there's too many games, you know, there's too many games, you know, it's boring, whatever else.
It was.
You're still hammering every other sport. And it's a domestic product. It's not an international product. So cricket's a massive winner out of all of this.
I'll be interested half...
Because it's comparing against nothing.
Well, it's beating, but is it... Again, is it enough to sustain it commercially? That's essentially the question.
Because someone says, the 400,000 is a low figure. You're marrying that up against AFLW or basketball, that's 20.
But I don't think they're up against those competitions. They're up against themselves to a degree to get the financial realities.
That's right. For what they paid for it.
Yeah, whether or not they can get a return on it. I mean, they can have plenty of people watching, that's fine. And compared to those other sports, but because there's so many other sports and you get your little niche markets that follow those, the number for cricket isn't, they're not comparing themselves to the NBL or the AFLW or whatever it might be. They're comparing themselves to the numbers they need to hit budget. That's what they'd be doing. Ben Everill is our PGA Tour correspondent who's joined us on the line. Good morning, Ben.
Yeah, good morning, guys.
I do want to ask you about the Matt Kuchar situation and how much that is affecting him as a person and how much it's being spoken about this week at Riviera. And maybe just refresh our listeners as to what exactly took place, because he's under the pump.
Yeah, look, obviously, last November on tour, he went to the Mayakoba Classic in Mexico and didn't have his regular caddy, who couldn't make the trip for personal reasons. And he took a local caddy, if you will, that week and made a sort of deal with him, you know, we'll have $3,000-$4,000 sound for the week and we'll add a bonus if we do well. Now, of course, history shows that Cooch won that tournament, won $1.2 million and gave the caddy the bonus of effectively another $1,000 and gave him a $5,000 total, which that caddy rightfully was a little bit annoyed with, you know, thinking that the usual 10% might not be in order, but something sort of getting close to it. Over the last few months, that sort of information has leaked, and Kuchar originally just didn't think it was a story and didn't think anything else. Thought he'd given the guy a good deal, giving him more money than he usually gets in a week. But with the pressure of social media, if you will, finally this week, he backflipped, caved, and sent El Toucan, as he's known, $50,000 for that effort. So thankfully, we've come to a spot where, you know, we've got the right, I guess, result in the end, even though it's given his reputation quite a serious battering in the process.
Was there discussion from the playing ranks about that? Were they talking about it, the players?
Oh, yeah. Look, it was, you know, under wraps. Obviously, not many people were saying much on it publicly, but the caddies especially and then the players were sort of suggesting that, you know, this is not a good look for a guy who's basically traded off being the Mr. Nice guy his whole career, you know. And to be honest, you talk to a few experts, the $50,000 he's eventually paid, this guy is actually dwarfs what it might cost him in terms of image and whatnot going forward, because, you know, it's taken a shine off, that for sure. I mean, and Kuch generally is a nice guy. I just think sometimes these guys, I guess, can be a little bit clueless, you know, when it comes to that sort of thing. And I think he took a long time for him to realise how much sort of public perception was not in his favour here.
I'm not sure how $5,000 and 1.2 is ever going to be kosher, ever going to be seen as appropriate.
But it's just that stigma now that's going to keep with him. I know Wayne Riley, an Australian golf commentator who's commentating at Riviera, he said, "Oh, look, if I'm Matt Kuchar playing in Matt Kuchar's group, I wouldn't mark my ball with a quarter because Kuchar might pick it up."
And let me tell you this, boys. I spoke with the President's Cup International team captain, ahead of being there in December, boys, and he is really adamant that the Melbourne fans need to turn a bit footy-like when we're there this year. And that means, obviously, not necessarily sledging in backswings or that, but just making sure the boys know the sort of mental disintegration Australia can be famous for. And he suggested that maybe since Australia has $1 coins, we might sort of put a collection together on each team, flick them Kuchar's way, you know. So perhaps the Melbourne faithful can apply.
Winks is starting to chime into it. Bowman still sits pretty at the furlong. Happy Clapper. Clipperton goes for home. But here she comes now, Winks. She just sidles up on the outside, takes the lead and draws away again. Age shall not weary the champ. Once again, she's haughty and imperious. Winks makes it a third Apollo Stakes, two lengths to Happy Clapper.
It was imperious, absolutely. Her performance in the Apollo Stakes, and Peter Tsai would have been sitting there licking his lips at how good she's come back to her form, and he joined us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning, Pete.
Yeah, good morning, fellas.
Great to have you on. Great to have Winks back racing. Do you measure her? I mentioned in the intro that almost back to her best. Do you measure her against any yardstick, or is it just whatever happens on the day?
Oh, no, it's just her physical appearance and mental appearance that she, or mental state that she, comes back and enjoys racing, and she proved to us on Saturday she broke the race record. She won by a bigger than expected margin, and she looked $1 million. So we're very happy the way she's come back, and very happy to be continue racer.
I reckon she looked about $20 million, but just at the moment. But were you in the build up? And she obviously tried okay a couple of times, and she'd never been a magnificent trialer in terms of winning trials. But were you bullish about her prospects on the weekend to race like she did and break the race record?
Yeah, we were always apprehensive. I mean, they don't give you the races, so we, you know, everything went to plan. So we were happy with what the preparation had done and how she'd come through with the trials and everything. But, you know, there's always the element of luck you've got to get, and you've got to beat the opposition. They don't, like I said, they don't hand it up to you. So, but, you know, as the race unfolded, it just became apparent that she was back to her best and looking the goods and won accordingly.
Did she surprise you? I mean, it's because we were talking this morning about the effortless nature of the victory, and it's something we've seen obviously lots of times before, but as she gets a bit older, I guess you're never too sure.
No, that's probably the truth. We're looking for something that, you know, that hasn't happened before, because she is getting older, and you would expect that maybe, you know, she doesn't do it as easily or whatever, but she defies age and everything else to be able to come out and just put away a field of pretty good horses. They weren't slow coaches, and She makes it look so easy, though, for us. It's, you know, she made feeling when she gets out and does what she does and sort of indicates that we've raced her on after the Cox Plate.
I think everyone is envious of the position you're in to own arguably one of the greatest racehorses of all time. But can you explain to us the emotion attached to, especially with this winning sequence going, can you enjoy it when you go to the races, or is it just complete nervousness of keeping the streak going and making sure she gets around and not get injured? What's it like?
Oh, it's hard to explain, you know. Like I say, the anticipation, the waiting gets you. I mean, you know, you know a week out that you're going into the race, and it's a full-on week of waiting just to make sure everything's all right. But, yeah, look, you wouldn't say we're getting used to it or we can handle it any better. There's just so many people that, you know, so many well-wishers, and she so means so much to so many people. It's not just us anymore. It's not only Australia wide, but around the world, you know. So, yeah, it's just a buzz and a great feeling, and the whole week before the race is really a blur.
So, Peter, Chris Wallace spoke on the weekend about the owners, you guys, considering cancelling for the staff when she retires because she's had such an impact on their lives. Can you just talk us through that a little bit more and why you think that will be important?
Oh, it's probably just really Chris Waller, and, you know, He's a forward thinker. That's what all you can say. And you know, he knows it's going to be tough for, you know, the handlers that have basically lived with her for 4 years. I mean, they get a break when she has a bit of a break, but they live and breathe her, and you know, she's part of their life. So I mean, I think he's just preempting, you know, what could be, and just making sure that you know, the right steps are taken. That he's looking after his he's like, he looks after his horses. He wants to make sure he looks after his staff, because they're paramount in the operation of Chris Waller Racing.
Have you thought about what, have you been able to look forward, or are you just too busy living in the moment to look forward to think about what it'll be like for you as one of the owners without Winks?
No, and it's probably better you don't think too far ahead. Just being an owner, we're just happy to take it as it comes. And, you know, we race other horses, so it's not just, we're not living and breathing Winks. We've got horses, you know, around the place. And, you know, we love the racing, so it's not just, we didn't just turn up with Winks. We've raced horses for 25 years.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, it'll be very sad the day that she retires, but, you know, life will go on, racing will go on, and we'll just have this treasure trove of memories to look back on and feel as proud as we do now. So it's, you know, it's sad in one way, but as you blokes all know, you've got to retire sooner or later, whether you're a footballer or a racehorse or any other type of sportsman. So, yeah, we'll take it in our stride as it comes and try to do the right thing and make sure that, we appreciate it while we got it.
Peter Tye, part owner of Winks, is with us on The Breakfast Club on RSN 927. Do those other horses you race, do they disappoint you, Pete? Do they disappoint you for not being so awesome?
Oh, look, you know, it's like having a bunch of kids, mate. You know, like, you've got one kid that's a star and the others are, you know, busting the gut, they're trying to be as good. You know, we love them all. We love racing. You get a little bit disappointed that, you know, it doesn't go to plan every time, but yeah, that's what it's all about. It's about the competition. It's about enjoying the racing and making sure that, you know, all the horses are looked after exactly the same, it's funny to say. So it's, you know, whether it be Winks or a horse we have raced on the weekend that didn't do any good, they all get looked after and treated the same way. And, you know, we're looking forward to the next start with a lot of them. It mightn't have happened on the weekend, but we hope that in the future they can win a race or two.
So, Pete, I'm sure you've got this campaign perfectly mapped out for her, but we all want to know about the potential for a wild card at the All-Star Mile. Will you guys consider that?
Look, it's probably a great concept. It's a great race, and we've been invited, you know, like we've been told about it to nominate, but look, it's just probably come a bit late for her. That's the real truth. She's a rising 7-year-old, and, you know, you've got to set your goals realistically, and to try to change a programming that was done, you know, we've done early in the year before the All-Star Mile came out. So we'd be happy to race under normal circumstances, but there's so many races. There's the All-Star Mile in Melbourne. There's the Everest in Sydney. There's a multitude of races that we could change a program and go to, but it's not in Winx's best interest. So her best interest are what we're looking after, so that, you know, we can keep her at a peak without having to change things. So we appreciate all of the well wishes and Melbourne and everybody in Racing Victoria that have asked us to come down, but it just would be one step too far at this stage. You know, like, you can't say never, never, but that's the hardest thing, is changing a programming.
Well, that was going to be my question, because it's been pretty clear, or you've made it pretty clear, what Winx's path would be this preparation. But if she kept winning the way she did on Saturday, would it be a temptation to look at potentially changing things?
Oh, look, it's very hard. I mean, it's programs change with, like, if she were to be injured or get hurt or weather change or weather patterns or, you know, something like that. That's what changes your programming, not particularly me. It's not what I say or what Chris says. He'll be guided by what's best for the horse. So, I mean, you know, if they have a deluge of rain in Sydney and it doesn't stop raining for 2 weeks and, you know, the tracks are all washed out and whatever, then you would look at doing something. But, I mean, the chances of that are very low. And so the chances of us changing the programming are very low. So that's sort of the best way I can explain it. But we have nothing wrong with, you know, we'd be more than happy to come to the All-Star Mile if it was, you know, probably put on a couple of years ago, and you would seriously look at putting it into her programming. But all these races that are fantastic races have come probably in the twilight of her career, and it would just not be in her interest to change it for her.
She's had a pretty good record in the Cox Plate of recent years, Pooh, which you're very well aware of. My understanding is the idea was always to get through the autumn and that would be it. Is that subject to change?
Not really. I mean, it's better that we look at putting a finishing point on it now. You know, it could all finish tomorrow. I mean, if she wakes up and she's not, you know, fully fit and healthy, and the vets advise against running her, that's what it would all help. It all finish then. We won't take any chances with her. That's for sure. But we've penciled in those races, and if we want her to become a mum later in the year, that's about the time we have to pull her up and send her out to the farm and get her ready to for the breeding season. So it's sort of like that's the timing you do. By running and winning the Cox Plate last year, that took us out of that breeding season. So, and it gave us this opportunity, which we're only doing because she has come back so well.
Yeah.
But if we'd decided to pull the pin last year, she would have, and we didn't do a Cox Plate, she would well and truly be breeding now.
So, Pete, all going well and she's in perfect order, what will be the remainder of her campaign this time round?
All going well. It's just under 2 weeks now to the Chipping Norton Stakes on the 2nd of March. Then we go through to the George Ryder on the 23rd of March. And again, fingers crossed, everything's sweet. We'll go into the Queen Elizabeth on the 13th of April. And that would hopefully be, you know, if she gets there, that will be her swan song.
Tate, it's here. Yeah. It should be caught. Man stuns underneath it.
Oh,
catch is taken. Cameron White takes the catch. 7 for 19. And that, well, may be the end of the hopes.
Maybe the end of the hopes. It was curtains for the Marvel Stars. They collapsed 7 for 19. If you don't mind, seemingly cruising at Marvel Stadium, chasing the Renegades 145. And Dave Hussey would have been sitting there with his head in his hands, a former superstar, former captain of the Melbourne Stars, watching it all unfold from a charity game he's involved in as well. He joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Huss.
Morning, Huss. How are you?
I'm going well. Is your head out of your hands at the moment?
Well, I actually finished the charity game and made the quick journey or dash to Marvel Stadium and pretty much watched the second half of the bowling innings and then the batting innings, and I actually got the feeling that I might have been the jinx. So as soon as I arrived, the staff started playing poorly, so I should have just stayed at the charity game.
Well, let's touch on the charity game first before we get to the details of the Big Bash final, which we are really keen to get your insight into. You're part of Matty's Shield yesterday, the Matty Rewalt, Matty's Vision charity. You captained the team. You're chasing down 189, I think, by Team Rewalt. Were you confident, Huss?
No, not at all confident, especially with some of the performance we have in our team. But, yeah, we managed to get the job done. But I'll tell you what it was. See some of the cricket, some of the footballers play cricket. Like, they're still very much competitive beasts, and they're definitely talented in both sports. Like the likes of Jonathan Brown storming in, bowling left-armers, and striking a nice cricket ball, and seeing Paul Salmon and roll him down. So it would have been quite a handy fast bowler in his time, and also seeing one of the greats of Victorian cricket, in Simon O'Donnell, just striking the ball to all parts. It was it was quite a joy to play in, actually.
Was there a seat coloured in for Scuba, just so he'd have something to aim at, like there is at the MCG?
No, but I did ask him about that. I said, how on earth did you hit Greg Matthews turning into you over mid-off so high up on the MCG? And he was a little bit humble, and he pretty much said, oh, I think it must have caught a wind or something, because there's no way you can go that far. And even with the bat technology back then, it's almost impossible, he kept saying. So, yeah, humility at its highest, I guess.
Was he using the jumbo that day, yeah, or the giant? The GN giant was his two bats that he went big with. Simon O'Donnell, it was great to watch him bat back in the old days.
So, look, Huss, turning our attention now to the Big Bash, what happened? Is do we put it down to that's T20 cricket, or was it just a massive choke?
Yeah, it's a tough one, really, to answer. From my point of view, this is how I would... If I'm batting, say, 4, 5, 6, I'm thinking none for 80, none for 90, we're flying. I might not have to bat here, you know. We're just going to cruise this in a canter, and then complacency sets in, and then all of a sudden your focus goes off from, right, my role is sort of scoring 7, 8 runs and over. This is how I'm going to go about it, run my twos, sort of hit threes, four, like the odd four, and I've got Cameron Boyce to target. I've got one over of Kane Richardson sort of thing, and... So sort of complacency may have set in a little bit, but once the Renegades got in a run, the Stars just couldn't find an answer. They, they sort of forgot all their focuses of playing some blue-collar cricket, of running twos sort of less focus on the boundaries or the sixes rather than just focusing on the twos.
I was talking earlier about the fact that the Stars maybe went a bit slow when they batted. To be none for 93 is fantastic, but they could have potentially at least one of them gone a bit faster, and then when both get out and you need 8 runs and over with two fresh batsmen, it created a bit of pressure that they probably didn't need.
Well, to quote my brother, he always says that however hard it is out in the middle, it's always going to be harder for the next person coming in. So the openers, I think they really need to take the full responsibility and go all the way and try and win the game in the 17th and 18th over. And I think what you're alluding to at the start, in the first six overs, I think, I thought Dunk played quite well in the first six overs, whereas Stoyan was sort of batting under 100, and maybe he could have taken a few more risks, especially in full well knowing that the wicket was going to slow down, and with Harry Gurney bowling a lot of slow balls out of the back of the hand, Dan Christian bowling, not too dissimilar to a Dwayne Bravo, I guess, a lot of slow balls and a lot of Yorkers as well. I think maybe they could have read the situation better and realised, look, we need to be 60 off our first six overs and go a bit harder.
Well, that was what I was inferring to earlier this morning, because, and I'm interested in your thoughts in this with all the experience you've had in T20 international cricket, about the chase and not sort of being dictated to by the scoreboard, but playing a particular tactic to make sure that the chase is done as easily as possible?
Well, yeah. The way I used to look at the par score, on the bottom left hand of every scoreboard, there's a par score. And I always looked at that, and that was sort of like the Duckworth Lewis score. So if you're always around that figure, you're sort of generally in control of the game. And if I'm chasing a lowish target of just under 150 yesterday, I'm trying to get as many runs in the first six, and then the rest of the chase is easy. That means all the pressure's on the Renegades. They've got to set attacking fields to try and take wickets to put a lot of pressure on the Stars, middle order and lower order play. So for mine, you're always trying to get it down to 6.5 to 7.5 runs and over, and then it's just pretty much a canter in the second half of the game.
So it's less about wickets in hand and more about focusing on what that required run rate is, just to keep it easier for the guys that haven't batted yet.
Yeah, but then you also, probably to contradict myself a little bit, you don't want to lose too many wickets in the power play as well. So you sort of got to adapt. Generally, if you lose 3 wickets in the power play, you're in a lot of trouble. And I know the Renegades, they lost 3 wickets in the power play, but they're also unlucky too to lose a couple of those wickets as well. And like Aaron Finch getting run out off the bowler's foot, it's a hard way to go. But it's all about adapting to certain situations. First six overs are critical, but you try and take as many runs as possible without losing a maximum of 3 wickets, I guess.
Will that scar them? And I know that you went through some challenging times with the Stars not being able to win, having had really good regular seasons. But to lose the unlosable, what sort of impact would that have on that team?
Oh, massive. I know all the boys, they got together last night and just had a quiet drink. And, it was deflating. I didn't go. I was just caught up with some of the boys by text message. And, they're pretty flat. I know from my experience, we lost against the Thunder, and I was captain, and I'm still not over it now. So it's pretty deflating, and I'm one of those players that never get over things very, very quickly or easily. So I know this is going to be driving the boys and burning in the boys' system for many years to come.
Yeah, I reckon it might. But the Big Bash is, I think it's been going 8 years? Is that what we've had all teams play in the finals, and I think only two haven't played in a grand final throughout that time. So it's actually become quite a competitive tournament through the first 8 years. When it first started, Hus, just going back a little bit for you, what did you think it could be, the Big Bash?
Yeah, I thought it could have been, I thought it was the future of cricket at the time. I just thought it was a great product. I thought all the fans came out and supported. I thought it really encouraged the kids to play cricket again and fall in love with the game. So I always knew it was going to be reasonably big. I probably didn't realise it was going to be that big until maybe free-to-air TV and Channel 10 took it over. And I thought they really revolutionised the game. And I thought a lot of fans really got involved, and it really made cricket attractive again. So it's a pretty exciting version of cricket.
Hus, we spoke about experience within sport and being so important. Dan Christian over those the semi-final and the final was absolutely phenomenal. Does it just show you why that within any sport that we need those older guys to continue to push through?
It's a great point, Rama. if you look at the whole of the BBL, and generally, say in the qualifying games, young v old, it's pretty much a 50-50 split. Whoever wins the certain time of the game, whereas in the postseason or the finals time, young v old, it's generally 9 times out of 10 the older or the more experienced player comes away with a win with those critical moments. So Dan Christian's finals campaign is just phenomenal. Without the Renegades recruiting him this year, they would have probably finished maybe 7th or 8th. So he's had an unbelievable year, and not just for the Renegades too. He's won trophies all over the world. So, yeah, he's a three-dimensional player, bats, bowls, fields, but probably most impressive from him, he just reads all situations really well. The way he anchored the innings yesterday, he got himself in. He took calculated risks when he batted, and the Renegades would not have got anywhere near 147 without him playing.
It was a dramatic day at Marvel Stadium yesterday, without a doubt. For the Big Bash final, a million people watching, probably more than a million. We haven't got the numbers just yet, but would have been big numbers for the broadcast as well. Moving on to the international stage, just for a second, Huss, we learned over the last 24 hours or so that Pat Cummins is now the number one ranked bowler on the planet. When he first came back after having those injury issues, did you think it would take a little while for him to become the bowler that he is and the cricketer that he is, or were you pretty much think this is on par with the timeline you'd set for him?
Well, it's a tough one to answer because you just want stars, genuine stars playing the game, and I'm always that one where I just love watching Paddy Cummins play, whether it's batting, bowling, fielding. He always gives 100%, so for him to be ranked number one bowler in the world is a justification of A, how hard he's worked, but also B, what a quality player he is. And I'm just hopeful, I just don't want him to break down again. That's probably my my thought in the background. But I think he's on target to be one of the greats of Australian fast bowling, and hope he does because he's a good quality person and always plays the game in the right way.
Is he our best cricketer at the moment?
Or
most important?
Yeah, probably most important. Him or the captain are probably the most important. He bats, he bowls, and he fields, doesn't he? So he competed against the Indians, and I thought he was the player of the tournament against the Indians for the Australian team, I should say. He's just a world-class player, and he's a must. You're probably right. He is probably ranked number one player in Australia at the moment. Yes.
One last one on Andrew McDonald. Took over the coaching role at Victoria in 2016. And in that short time, he's won the Sheffield Shield, he's won a JLT Cup, and now a Big Bash. So that's the triple crown here in Australia for domestic cricket. Firstly, just a word on why he's so good, and have you been surprised at how quickly he's had an impact the way he has?
Well, it's a tough one to answer because he inherited pretty much a very good squad. And he sort of, without speaking ill of Andrew, Victorians probably haven't got the recognition of all the international players. They've always had the best state players available to play all Sheffield Shield or JLT Cup available at all times. So that's definitely a help. But he also has the best of the facilities and the players that they drive themselves to become the best possible players they can be. So he's a very good man manager. He gets the best out of all players. I think just the role clarity, whatever the game situation is, I think he communicates that very, very well. And he also has very good assistant coaches in Lockie Stevens and Dimi Mascarenhas with the Renegades, and Lockie Stevens and Mick Lewis with the Victorian team. So you always got to have good helpers as well. So it's a really nice collective group at the moment with the Victorian team, and hopefully it continues for many years to come.
Let's turn our attention now to AFLW for a second. On the weekend, the Blues travelled to GWS up at Blacktown and for the first time in over 12 months walked away with the 4 points. And I'm sure Nicholas Stevens, one of the star defenders, was very, very pleased about that. Nick, good morning.
Morning, Haas. How are you guys?
We are going very well, thank you. Nice to have you on board. What was it like, finally, after 12 months, getting that victory? As the siren went and you ended up in front, what was it like?
Oh, it was such a great feeling. I think a lot of the girls were quite emotional after such a long time of getting a win on the board, but I think part of it was relief too, and it was really just reward for effort over the last, few months that we've been putting in the hard yards in pre-season, And it was just really great to be able to experience that with the group.
So, Nick, now Daniel's walked out of the studio. Now, we know Daniel is the host in here, and he's pretty good at his job.
No, I haven't walked out, and don't be stupid.
What's he like as a coach? We all want to know because we see him in here. He's bubbly. He's enthusiastic. Is that what he's like as a coach also? Oh,
wow. Yeah, he is. He's just like a big kid. He gets along with us really well. Knows when he wants to have some fun and knows when to be serious too. So I think it's a pretty good balance.
Now, what changed? What changed? We go back to week one against North Melbourne and they just simply outplayed you. Last week was better and then obviously on the weekend, the win. What changed for you guys? Where did this win come from? And is there a hell of a lot more of this to come?
Yeah, look, I think this season is such a high-pressure situation and we know that we want to start with our best foot forward, but I just don't think we're ready yet. And I think we needed to start believing in ourselves a little bit more. And, you know, each week was better. The game against North Melbourne wasn't great. And then the week after was a little bit better. And I think we're able to just put four quarters together after we start believing we could actually do it and trust in the processes that we've put in place over the last few months.
So where does that come from? When you say you didn't think you were ready, then where does that belief then come from over the next 2 weeks that go, okay, hang on a minute, let's reassess what we're doing here and play the way that you played on our Saturday?
I think sometimes you can get a bit caught up in the bigger picture sort of stuff and it become a little bit too overwhelming. And I think Harf really, you know, goes on about with us just focusing on the small moments and trying to get done what's in front of you. And if you get carried away worrying about what's going to happen next, then you can't really put your best foot forward in the game in the minute that you're in and the contest that you're in at the time. And I think that's something that we really tried to focus on as players just to get us through those small moments and win the little things along the way.
What about the mental hurdles of having not won for such a long time? You got in a winning position last week against Adelaide. For that not to become this massive sort of noose around your neck, how did you overcome that?
Yeah, I think it's really heartbreaking when you know that you're good enough to do it and you really just have to focus the whole way through the game. And you know, winning is actually a skill, and it's been so long since we've actually won a game, and it's really hard to hold that position against, especially such a good side against Adelaide. And you know, the win now has just given us confidence to move on to the next challenge, and I think that's really the kickstart that we needed. And you know, to take that into the rest of the season, I think we're in a pretty good position now.
Did you feel that pressure?
Yeah, you do. You know, a lot of the girls do. I feel it quite a lot, and you know, it's just about bringing it back to the president and worrying about what you got to do next and how you can influence the next contest.
And how much of that, Nick, is the 7-week season and the 1-year contract status for everyone in the competition, that there's not only the game pressures and the scoreboard pressures, and so to speak, but there's almost career pressures as well?
Yeah, I think it plays a pretty big part, and the season's just jam-packed in a few weeks. And ideally, we'd like to be playing for a much longer period throughout the whole year, but you know, there's other girls on the list. There's quite a number of other girls on the list that are really trying hard to get a game. And, you know, that's really hard for them too. And it's just the reality of where AFLW is at the moment in time.
Nick, I want to ask you about the game in itself, the season itself. I've watched probably the most I've ever watched this season, and I'm really enjoying it. I think it's improved. But there's still some girls that feel the need to make comment on social media about that people are... that are knocking the competition still. Where do you sit on that? Are you one where you just want to let the football do the talking, or do you feel there's a need to comment at times against those people that are knocking the competition?
Look, I think the football can do most of the talking. And if you go back and look at, if you reflect on the first season and that season that was, and it was incredible to watch and it was groundbreaking. And every year since then, it's just the competition's just got better and better. And quite a number of times after this, my game this year and watching some of the other teams play, I'd say to my friends and family, like, oh, did you watch, you know, the other game on the weekend? And quite often I catch myself saying, oh, it would have been a really good game to watch. And I haven't really been able to, I haven't said that much over the last couple of years, but this year particularly, I've really noticed a change in the quality of the game and how it's been played. And it looks like a really good brand of footy to watch. And I think it's really important to be able to call out people when, you know, they make sexist remarks and things like that. But if you look at the other side of it, the game is doing really well for itself. And, you know, there's so many women and girls playing footy, and I like to just focus on that sort of thing rather than get too caught up in all the rest of it.
Is it tougher to play because the standard's gone up, or is it actually easier to play with the standard going up because you can anticipate a little bit more about what's happening and it actually is a bit more predictable?
Yeah, 100% right with that one. I reckon it makes it a little bit easier to play, a lot more fluid and predictable, like you said. It's just really exciting. I wish I was 18 and Matty Prespakis and starting all again so I can play for, you know, even longer.
What about Matty? She's had a big couple of weeks. She was a rising star last week. She had another big performance on the weekend. Is this the start of things to come, do you think, with the players that have grown up playing the game since they were eight or Auskick or whatever it might have been, and they come into the game as ready-made footballers? Is she a sign of the times?
Yeah, definitely. She is just a class above, I think. You can really tell the difference between the girls that have been playing since they were young kids. And not just been playing and kicking the footy with their brothers and sisters in the backyard, but actually had that access to the elite talent pathway the whole way through. And you can really see that within her, with her skills and how she understands the game and how she uses that learning to help other people as well. It's really exciting to see what the future holds with footballers just like Maddie.
Are you paying much attention to the conference system at the moment, Nick?
I am, yes. We're on top of the ladder in Conference B, which is really exciting. But it's quite an interesting situation to be in. I think if you took out the A and B, then I think the ladder wouldn't change any position, which is quite interesting, but gives us an extra chance, and we just got to focus on winning games, I guess.
The NBL Awards were held. Of course, the final's coming up. It's Thursday week at Melbourne Arena, where Melbourne United host the Sydney Kings in game one of their semi-final campaign, and the United boys will have to come up against the NBL's MVP, because Andrew Bogut took that out last night at the awards for 2018-19. He's been good enough to join us this morning on the Breakfast Club. Congratulations, Bogey.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Great stuff. When you came back, what were you trying to achieve? Now, clearly you've got work to do with the Sydney Kings through the finals campaign, but personally, what did you want to achieve back in the NBL?
Exactly that. Obviously, the end goal for us for the team is to get to an NBL championship and try to win that thing. Obviously, the club hasn't been in the finals for a number of years in a row, and just trying to bring success back to the Sydney Kings. So that was the first goal, and I think everything that happens so far between that, individual awards and whatnot, happen when your team is successful.
I was interested to hear when you made your speech last night after the award, that you manage yourself pretty carefully through the training week to make sure you're right for the game day. Now, you've had a history of some injuries through your time in the NBA. Is that on the back of that, or is that just the aging body and just now you're knowing yourself much better to be able to get yourself up for those occasions?
Yeah, I think it's a good mix of both. Obviously, we have all our games on weekends here in the NBL pretty much, so you generally have 4 or 5 days to back up. So it's just a matter of not being hard-headed. You know, I do love training. I do love getting out there and mixing it up. And I don't like missing days just to miss days. But there's been days where I've had to just say, hey, you know, a little sore here, a little sore there. I'll do some rehab and some physio so I can back up for that next weekend. So that's the beauty of the NBL for me. It's, you know, NBA, you're playing on a Tuesday and a Thursday and a Friday and then a Sunday. And if you get a little niggle, it's kind of hard to battle through. But this provided an opportunity for me to stay healthy. And I'm kind of pretty happy that I got through all 28 games and was healthy throughout the year.
What happens with the team will be determined in the next few weeks. But from a personal point of view, was it an aim almost to come and try and win the MVP to sort of just put your mark on this competition? Or with what you've done in the past, that didn't really bother you, just going to come back and play?
No, to be honest with you, not really. Look, my game isn't really traditionally an MVP on paper. Game. I'm not a guy that's going to average 20 points a game and do all this splashy stuff. But I know I can affect the game in an MVP way. So, you know, obviously leading rebounds and block shots and having one of the best defenses in the league, being able to pass the ball, set good screens, all that kind of stuff that doesn't show up on a stat sheet, I know I'm elite at. Unfortunately for me, you know, the coaches voted me in with that.
Oh, just lost him. You still there?
Yep.
Yeah, sorry, that was alarm going off. Yeah, basically, like I said, I was fortunate enough to have coaches and rival teammates see that, see my impact when I played against them and voted me in.
So, Andrew, did you get then as much or if not more satisfaction out of winning the Defensive Player of the Year award?
Yeah, I love that award. I think that's a really good award for me. I think I'm that old school type player coach mentality of if you don't play defense, you're not going to have a chance to win a championship. That's a cliche, but it definitely holds true. And all the great teams I've been on that had any success have played good defense. So to get that award, it was very special.
So looking at the season as a whole for you guys and for the league, it was as close an NBL season as I've seen in a long time, all bar Cairns, who only won the six games, but on Friday night were able to beat Melbourne United. Where do you see the league as a whole in itself, Andrew? You obviously played at the highest level for many, many years in the NBA, but do you see now the more and more better players? I know it's difficult within Europe because they still earn so much money there, but just this competition going from strength to strength and getting better players coming in?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, there's only 8 teams at the moment, 9 next season, which is both a positive and a negative. The negative is that we want more teams, but the positive is that roster spots are at a premium, mate. So, you know, there's a lot of guys that aren't playing in the NBL right now from Seabull and the lower leagues that probably should deserve a spot, but they just can't be fit in. This crop of imports that we've had have been some of the best that I've seen playing in the NBL. It's a competitive level, and you know, a 3-way tie for first is, it shows that this league is very competitive. Cairns, who's finished dead last, beat Melbourne United, who were first this last weekend. So anything could happen throughout the year, and it was a rollercoaster ride for most teams, including us. Like, we hit some lulls where we lost to a few of the bottom teams and then beat the top teams and vice versa, and it gets frustrating a little bit, but it just shows how close and talented the league is.
So you spoke about, obviously, the schedule of playing an NBA season and how difficult that was. How have you settled back into life in Australia by, you know, playing a couple of games potentially on a weekend and training? Has that been a big change to your routine at home?
Yeah, babysitting a little more. I enjoy it. I enjoy being home with the family. I'm a homebody. I don't like getting out and about too much. So I've actually enjoyed just being able to be around the kids more, and you know, it's the most vital part of their life. We had two under two as of 2 months ago. One's now, you know, two years old and 3 months. But I just think it's a vital part of their life, and I wanted to be around as much as possible and not miss key moments. So being in the NBA doesn't really allow you to do that too much. But you know, in the NBL it's a little bit easier. We have training in the morning, and then I basically have the whole afternoon to take the kids out of the park and do different things.
So what's in the build-up to next Thursday week against Melbourne United for Game 1 of the semis? What's the program? It's a good chance to recuperate, I imagine, for the entire squad.
Yeah, it really works well for us, that break, just because we're an older squad, a lot of 30-year-olds like myself, so we get some rest. United have had our number in the regular season. They're 3-1 in the regular season series. Played us very, very well, very well coached, very talented, and at the end of the day, they're the champions. So if we want to do anything, we've got to go through the champions. We'll start preparing our scout and what we're going to do and how we can try to stifle them as they will be doing us, and hopefully go out there and put on a good show and win the series.
So winning the 2 awards last night, surely you have to reward yourself in some little way. What car have you got your eye on?
No bonuses, no MVP bonuses in the NBL, mate. So usually the rule in the NBA is you got to get your teammate something, so I'll figure out what I'm going to get then first and foremost, and then probably just enjoy a good meal when I get back to Sydney.
Did you work out, I was following your Twitter feed on the weekend, did you work out the right-hand conversion laws? Yeah. Has that changed or not?
I don't know, mate. Our government's like a chess game, mate. It's all over the place. So I'm not sure where it's at. I did read that if the car's not made here, that you can keep it right-hand drive. Since then I've read that you can't. So who knows? Who knows what's going on? But it's a coin flip. We'll see. Maybe I should just import one and get pulled over and just see what happens.
We'll see how you go with that.
I've got a bit of a random question for you. When the NBL season finishes, with the way you've got through this year and your body's healthy, if an NBA team came knocking and wanted you to come back, would you do it?
I'll think about it, but right now, outside of playing these next 2 seasons, Sydney's kind of my focus. If anything else happens along from there, it'd be in the back of my mind, but it's not something that I'm advocating for right now. Like I said, it's to go through a whole season in the NBA is tough, from September all the way to June if you're in the finals. It's a long grind. So if the opportunity presents itself, we'll have a chat, but as of now, no.
Yeah, because is there a situation where you could actually just go over and be sort of traded in for the last part of the season that's currently underway now? I mean, because that is something that could happen.
he's done your research, haven't you? Yeah, that is possible. When you play overseas, there's a different rule. So when you play overseas, you can basically join a team up until the last regular season game. So there's a lot of guys from the NBL and Europe that tend to look at doing that. You know, if I get called, we'll see what happens. But as of now, nothing imminent.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.